I'm speaking with Yaver Hamid. Yaver Hamid is the lawyer for Abu Sufyan Abdurazzaq, a Montreal man who has been in limbo in the Sudan, unable to return to Canada, even though he's a Canadian citizen, for now 5 years. Yaver, welcome to No One's Legal Radio.
Thanks, Shaggy.
Yaver, the basic facts of this case, I think, are relatively clear, especially since documents have been obtained under the Privacy Act. Mr. Abdurazzaq is a Canadian citizen of Sudanese origin. He was, on the advice of Canadian officials, questioned and tortured by Sudanese officials. He has since been released, but he lays in limbo as he waits in Khartoum, Sudan, to return to Canada, where he's a citizen. He's been separated from his family for more than 5 years. I'm wondering if you could state simply, what are the key issues here? What are the rights, and what are the important issues that are to be kept in mind when we're considering the case of Abu Sufyan Abdurazzaq?
Well, the first issue, Jaggy, is that any Canadian citizen is allowed to leave and re-enter the country. That's a legal right, that's a legal entitlement that Canadian citizens have under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, Section 6. Now, there is attached with that right, there is a prerogative that the Canadian government has to issue a passport. However, the circumstances in which that issuance can be withheld is extremely narrow. In the facts of this case, there's no legal justification for withholding of a passport, which is part of the problem. But the real obstacle here is the fact that Mr. Abdurazzaq finds himself named on a list according to United Nations Resolution 1267, which presumes him to be associated with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Now, there is no there's no specific evidence or particulars for this allegation, and in fact, Canada doesn't know or claims not to know why he's even on this list. And so one of the issues is that how do we, as a population, how do we reconcile the fact that there is a constitutional right for all citizens to re-enter the country, and at the same time, our government, on the basis of mere suspicion or speculation, is willing to withhold the issuance of a passport and disallow a citizen from enjoying his constitutionally protected right.
Maybe I'll ask the question in a slightly different way. It might be the same response, but what's at stake? What's at stake if Abdurazzaq cannot return back to Canada? And what's at stake in general in when we consider the situation that he's in and what he's had to go through since approximately 2003?
If Mr. Abdurazzaq cannot come home to Canada, he will remain in Sudan. The only means by which he can come back to Canada, given the fact that he's named under United Nations Resolution 1267, is by intervention of the Canadian government. The Canadian government must issue him with a travel document, either an emergency travel document or a passport, and the Canadian government must intercede to bring him back. This is something that's allowable under international law, under United Nations Resolution 1735. This is clear. If Canada fails in basically exercising its discretion and what is incumbent upon it to repatriate one of its citizens, Mr. Abdurazzak is at risk of being detained again in Sudan, and he may find himself tortured or disappeared or even worse.
What has happened so far to Mr. Abdurazzak vis-a-vis the Sudanese officials and what they have done to him? What do we know? We know, or the claim has been made, that Mr. Abdurazzak might suffer torture. Has he suffered torture to this point at the hands of the of Sudanese officials?
Yes. Well, there are several concerns. I mean, the first one is the fact that he was arbitrarily detained on two occasions. He was detained without charge, without any formal indictment of any sort, without any reason or justification. He spent approximately 2 years in detention, and during this time he was deprived of basic needs. He was physically beaten, mistreated, kept in very difficult conditions. He had at the time several health conditions which were just aggravated, such as an asthmatic condition, a heart condition, degenerative eye condition, hearing problems. All of this has been aggravated because of the very difficult circumstances he had to live in during detention.
Yavor, we've learned that that documents under from documents obtained under the Privacy Act that Mr. Abdurazzak, who again is a Canadian citizen, was while incarcerated in Sudan, questioned by officials of the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service. Could you tell us more about what those documents reveal and what exactly happened as Mr. Abdurazzak was being questioned by CSIS while in the custody of Sudanese officials?
Mr. Abdurazzak was detained for the first time in probably the late spring, early summer of 2003. And in or about December of 2003, prior to having his first consular visit, he was visited while in detention by CSIS officials. CSIS officials questioned him for approximately 2 days, asking him a series of questions, a lot of questions which he had been asked about while in Canada as well. And they were very interested in knowing about his relationship to Canadians who were persons of interest for CSIS. And during this two-day inquisition, there was no concern for upholding his basic rights, for getting him consular assistance, for getting him out of detention. The concern was really to extract information from him. And so one of the questions is that were these officials aware of the circumstances in which he was detained initially? Were they aware of his ill treatment and torture by Sudanese officials? Through our information from a Privacy Act request, we've learned that the Canadian government was in fact complicit in ordering or instructing Sudanese officials to detain Mr. Abdurazzak in the first place.
Yavor, when we speak about CSIS officials interrogating potential suspects or asking them questions about other persons of interest, I don't think we can help but think, knowing what we know now, about the case of Meher Arar, where based on information that CSIS might or might not have gotten from somebody else, that Meher Arar was put under suspicion simply because he and another man signed the same lease, if I have my information right. And I can't help but thinking about the CSIS interrogation of Omar Khadr, which luckily we now see on video. And we see what those interrogations mean. And when it comes to CSIS, we're not talking about physical abuse of a prisoner, but certainly psychological abuse. And I'm wondering if you could break that down a bit. What are the worries that we might have knowing that CSIS undertook these interrogations of Mr. Abdelrazzak while he was in a Sudanese prison and asked him questions about other persons of interest? How does this fit in with this bigger picture of the case of Meher Arar, of the Yakabuchi Three, of Omar Khadr, and other cases as well?
Jaggi, I think the analysis is correct in the sense that it is part of a recurring pattern. It is part of a kind of treatment of Canadians in detention abroad, where our security intelligence service tries to come off looking like benevolent sort of investigators trying to get at the truth of a situation while deflecting the real context in which they find themselves. And this context is precisely that the individuals that they're investigating or interrogating are in the midst of an arbitrary detention, are in the midst of being tortured, and this is very much the fact of the case for Mr. Abdelrazzak. And the term that is sometimes referred to in a Canadian context for these kinds of cases is opportunistic rendition. And by that, I guess the reference is to the fact that being in the country of their dual nationality by their own means, having left by their own flight, the Canadian government takes advantage of dual nationals opportunistically being in another country and with some kind of complicity with the foreign government, avails of that situation, avails of essentially the fruits of torture to basically continue a line of questioning which would not be acceptable in a Canadian context. So this is really a form of opportunism which is quite egregious.
Yaver, people might be familiar with the case of Brenda Martin. She is somebody who was in custody in Mexico, and due to a campaign, the Harper government made sure that provisions were made so that when she was freed from prison, that she was returned back to Canada. It seems pretty simple. If you're a citizen and you find yourself in limbo somewhere, that there's an obligation by the authorities to bring you back, especially if you're in a situation such as in Khartoum in the Sudan, where to not do so can put you in a precarious situation. So what's really going on here? Why is it that Brenda Martin can be returned, and yet Mr. Abdelrazzak, who, unlike Omar Khadr, isn't in custody, he is free, quote-unquote, within the Canadian embassy. What's really going on? Why can't he be brought back like Brenda Martin was brought back and countless other Canadians that we never hear about who find themselves in a certain limbo anywhere around the world?
Jaggi, the unfortunate situation is that it is a situation of double standard, of kind of institutional racism, where because individuals who are Canadian citizens are also dual nationals, they are, in the eyes of the Canadian government, they are treated as second-class citizens. In this case, in the case of Mr. Abdelrazzak, the excuse that's being proffered by the Canadian government is that international law is an obstacle to his repatriation. The reality of the situation is that clearly, under international law, and more particularly under United Nations Resolution 1735, Canada has the clear right to repatriate Mr. Abdelrazzak and to do so by any means that are feasible. What appears to be the modus operandi of the Canadian government is to try to try to create some kind of international law pretext for inaction, and that's completely inappropriate. The reality is that under international law and under domestic law, he is entitled to come back to Canada, and the reason why he is not being given that right is because as a Muslim, as a person who was born in Africa, as a black man, he more easily falls under the cloud of suspicion in which he is cast by virtue of this listing on this nebulous United Nations 1267 listing.
Yavor, one thing that's been lost in all of this is the direct voice of Abdulrazak himself, Mr. Abdulrazak himself, as well as his family. And you're someone who's been in touch with Mr. Abdulrazak. You've been someone who's in touch with his family. I'm wondering if you could speak to them as people on a personal level. What have they been through? How are they surviving through this very difficult situation?
Mr. Abdulrazak has family in Montreal. He has a stepdaughter. He also has his own biological daughter, and his younger daughter, Jiria, is now about 14 or 15 years old. He has a young son in Ottawa from his ex-wife, who is now 5 years old. And the reality is that his son, Kuteba, he has not seen basically since the year he was born. So this boy, who's a beautiful young boy, and I've met him several times, he has grown up basically not knowing his father. And so the continuing situation of Mr. Abdulrazak's exile reminds him that he has not known his son. His whole period of detention and continued denial of opportunity to return to Canada is a reminder that he's been alienated from his family, and as such, his family is growing up without knowing him, without having a proper context in which to grow and learn. And this is obviously causes tremendous emotional difficulty for the family. And this is something that is very difficult for the family to cope with, understandably so.
Yavor Hamid, lawyer for Abul Sufyan Abdulrazak, thank you for speaking with us on No One Is Legal Radio.
Thanks, Jackie.